House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And this afternoon, we finished up TANF yesterday, and we're going to go into detailed program discussion. And I see Ramona shaking her head. And just some housekeeping items. Some of the senators are still in caucus, and I expect them down shortly. But if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please shut it off so that we don't interrupt the proceedings. And also, Rosie is with us today. And Rosie is our pig that is collecting funds that will go to feed the hungry when session is over. And Rosie accepts dollars and any amount you want to put in her when you use acronyms. And on the one hand, we're trying to discourage the alphabet soup. And on the other hand, we're kind of contradictory because we want to encourage you so that you feed Rosie because we think it's a worthwhile cause. And with that, Ramona and who else is coming up with you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the Foster Care Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families at the Department of Human Services. I, too, under Ms. Foley's advice, brought my dollars as well to share. So,
thank you.
She said she's going broke paying it all herself, so she's going to spread it around a bit. Today, my program area that I'd like to talk to you about is the out-of-home care. And what I intend to talk about today is to walk through our document that we provided to you and touch on the areas of programs as far as the definitions of what those programs are, who we serve, the program growth, what drives costs, and our performance outcomes. There's no other questions, then I'll just proceed. The Department of Human Services is the state agency that is responsible by statute to accept care for neglected and needy children. And we accept that care through the legal custody assigned to us by the state of Oregon as far as the courts. The out-of-home care services, we actually offer an array of programs and services for children needing care, and they're most clearly defined as the family foster care program. Family foster care is the mother and father in the community who provides care for children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days during the year. They're the bread and butter of the out-of-home care program and services. Additionally, in this program area, we are also talking about the relative care. So those are the families where children have come into the state care and custody, and then we have identified relatives for these kids to live with. So that might be grandma and grandpa, auntie, cousins, those individuals who are caring for their kin. Oftentimes, this program is referred to as kinship care. One of the other services that we provide is for independent living, and I'm on page 80, section 4, page 80 now. Independent living are services that are to enhance the child or the youth who lives in foster care to assist them in moving towards emancipation, towards independent living. And we provide those services beginning with children at age 14 and graduating then the number of services available to them throughout the course of time in foster care. The other area that we'll be talking about today is residential treatment services. Again, residential treatment services are for those youth who are unable to make it into a regular foster home and need a higher level of care. So we'll describe a little bit about those programs and services as well. The children who we serve children and families when children cannot remain safely in their homes. The array of services that we just discussed, or I just defined for you, are really for kids where they can stay so they can be safe while their family works on issues that brought them to the attention of the courts and brought them attention to the state until they can remedy the problems and to get these kids back home. We do that through a continuum of services, part of what I've outlined thus far. And those continuum services are really defined on the needs of the child. What are the needs of this child? Do they need a foster home? Do they need a relative home? Or do they need residential treatment services? By federal mandate, as well as best practice, those placement settings should always be the least restrictive environment possible. We don't want to take a three-year-old who has few problems and place them into a locked facility. That would not be least restrictive environment. So federal mandates and best practice really dictate looking at least restrictive environment. And so that's a common language that's used throughout our system. And the court system, as they review our cases, ask those questions routinely. Is this the least restrictive environment for this child? When the least restrictive environment is defined, oftentimes it is from the foster care and the kids are with relatives. Those are most often our places that we reside or use services. These children are, the majority of them are into our system as a result of some child protective service intervention that the state has been involved in. And yesterday you heard about the child protective system, and that's where these children are entering our doors. And they are then assigned temporary and or permanent custody of the state. And the state courts then assigns that temporary or permanent custody to Department of Human Services as defined earlier. Who we serve then is these kids, as they're served in a family foster care setting, they're provided with basic necessities of room and board, clothing, school, and personal incidentals. These services then are provided by the foster parents for which they live, foster parents and relatives who care for these children. The foster parents then are in turn reimbursed for a portion of the cost of care that it takes to raise these children by the department. Youth that are 14 and older, as I discussed earlier, are eligible to receive...
When you say older, what is the maximum age?
The maximum age is 18 in this state at this identified time. That means that if the court continues custody of the child up until they're age 18, then the children can actually receive those services, or youth. If the court decides to continue the care and custody of the child past the age of 18, they can so choose to. Oftentimes, the court may choose to keep the care and the custody and assign it to the department if the child is 18 but may still be in high school, may still need some assistance before they can be emancipated.
How many fall in that category?
I actually don't have that number with me, but I had the question yesterday, and I have folks working on it, and we can get that number to you. How many children are 18 and over? The children then that are in...
And when you give us that figure, could you give it for the 9901 biennium and 0103 so that we could have some comparison data?
Certainly.
Start with 97, really.
You want us to start with the 97 biennium?
Yes.
Okay. The independent living services are defined as a service array that we provide in the community, and it's provided through 17 different contractors around the state who provide these services to the youth. And what they're trying to teach them is independent living skills. Those are defined as basic living skills, money management, how to do a budget, how to start doing job search, how to develop your social skills and communication skills so you can go to a job and interview. They also are for helping kids understand what are informed decisions and some of the parenting, initial parenting information, health education. What is an informed consumer of health care? Not just the fact that they're getting health care, but what is an informed consumer? How do they seek those services out? So a lot of the children that are in our care and custody are youth that need that extra hand to help them towards emancipation, and certainly the state then is no longer having care and custody for some of these youth at 18. They're out there on their own, and so they need these skills developed ahead of time so that they're ready for that. The federal law actually mandates that we provide some level of independent living services for children in foster care, and they encompass then a CHAFE foster care independence program grant, federal grant that comes to our state, for which we have received legislative approval for a number of years to access those services, and that's how most of those are paid for. The chart on the opposite page you'll see is just a breakdown that I wanted to be able to show you that reflects the race and culture of children in our care, as well as the families that are providing care for these children, and it's to really show you a complement of where we're at now and where we have areas to grow in terms of making sure that kids are being served in the communities that they've come from.
What efforts are made in order to... I noticed that the Hispanic number of children in foster care is 11%, but actually the number of foster parents in homes is 5%. And the only place that it's really pretty comparable is if I look at the Asian Pacific Islander, and I believe Native American is close, but the African American and the Hispanic need for foster homes. What are you doing in order to try to reach that objective?
Yeah, a number of things, Chair Winter. We are looking clearly over the last several years within the department, looking at bilingual, bicultural staff. And clearly that's one of the avenues that get us partway there. Folks that understand communities and understand the communities from which they may be a part of, bringing children in. We have been providing increased efforts in the last several years around, specifically for the Spanish-speaking population, training materials, training conferences. The Foster Parent Association has done a very nice job last fall, and again, they're doing one this spring on training foster parents in their native language. And so they have folks that are coming in and providing specific Spanish training to those families, and so they're not always having to go through an interpreter to get that information. They're getting it right directly.
Has there been any effort to work with the Hispanic advocacy group to get them involved, since their kind of role and function in state government is to help to point out problems and issues?
Yeah, not directly. We do have a number of Spanish-speaking support groups for foster families that get together to talk about common problems, common areas. Oftentimes, one of the real critical places to recruit families for foster care is taking care of the ones you've got, and then they recruit their friends and neighbors and other friends and family. So clearly it is supporting those families that we do have and having them help us outreach to those communities as well.
Thanks.
I would then draw your attention to the program growth area. The average daily population for our out-of-home care, again, this is the broad out-of-home care, has been really stable for the last 4 years. In 2001, I've noted there that we've actually had more children leave foster care than entered, which is, I think, is a very good sign. The average daily population in out-of-home care is 6,797. And that number is very important to look at in terms of how many kids are we serving. But more importantly, I'd like to draw your attention to the numbers down below, which speak to the total volume that is actually coming in our doors that we're serving in a given year. And so these are for children who, if they experience foster care for one day, they're counted in this larger number. And for some youth that come in and they may be with us for 30 days, for 29 days, for 2 months, where their family is able to then take care of the problems and the children are able to go back home, those children are counted in this larger number. And it's being recognized because that's really where a workload issue is attached to those. We're serving all those children in a given year. The next area of program growth, I would show you that the graph on page 85 really reflects the age of the children, broken out in four different areas of where that trend line has been over the last several years. I then would move on to page 86. In this area, one of the growth areas has been our work with relatives and looking to find relative care for children whenever possible. When relatives are not available or not deemed suitable, meaning that they have not been able to meet the certification standards, then we must look for other areas for these children's placements. We find those families with family friends. We ask mom and dad, is there anybody else in your community? Do you know of other folks that might be able to care for these children? We check for neighbors. We look for teachers. We identify other people that are known to these children. And then we use certified foster families that we already have available. This is clearly the work and the efforts we've done over the last couple of years on developing neighborhood foster care programs, looking to keeping kids in their community, making sure that the school community is identified and kids are able to stay in their same school as much as possible. Over the last several years, you can see the breakdown of the percentage of relatives caring for children. And in this last year, we're reporting 25% of the children are placed with their relatives. The next brackets down will show you the number of families that we certified, and I would highlight the year 2001, which shows you a big jump right there. And I'd like to say that was because I came down the foster care program during that time, but realistically what it was is the federal mandate required us to start certifying all relative placements. Up until that period of time, we did not have to certify all the relative placements. We went out and did a quick safety check that those families did not have to go through training and all the other capacities that we had. And therefore, that's where the jump is. So we started certifying an additional 1,000 families per year. The other notion then is the factors that drive costs is really the cost of the basic care. It is determined by the age of the child in our system. And that age of the child is broken down, as you see, 0 to 5-year-olds, the 6 to 12, and the 13 and older youth. And I draw your attention to the fact that we also have 30.8% of our children are under 3 years of age that are coming into the system.
And I don't see here, but could you provide us with the cost of, for example, therapeutic foster care? There is some differences in cost of care that isn't in this particular range. So if you could, you know, later provide us some information on that particular cost of care. Also, and I don't know if it's in here, maybe further down, the residential foster care, shelter care cost. Okay. As well as residential treatment, because I know those are different costs.
Correct. And I have some information I can present to you. The basic cost, then, is really broken out for the foster care, the family foster care settings for children in the room and board, clothing replacement, and personal allowance. And so you can see what the chart is there. That's the new rate effective February 1, 2003. That's based on a 7.5% reduction in this program as a result of the recent budget issues. The primary reason then on page 88, the children are entering care. This is a chart you may be familiar with. And these children are coming in care because they've been exposed to a number of problems and a number of issues. As a result of these children, many of them have emotional, physical, and sexually been abused. And therefore, their emotional behavioral problems, mental health, or physical problems require specialized care and specialized services. The foster parents and relative caregivers, in turn, need increased special skills in order to care for these kids and to support these children. Many of these children then are with special needs that are in care. We have a program of special rates, personal care, which is a program that is we're able to through assessment of the children and their needs, provide additional costs or additional reimbursement to the foster parent to deal with some of the physical and mental health issues that these children might have. As of the end of December, 55% of the children in the foster care program, family foster care program, required this additional support. So this accounts for over 3,000 children in the system have this these needs for special needs care. Of those children, then, they're being served in, as I've noted, over 1,600 foster homes. So out of the 4,500 homes we have, these special need kids are in approximately one-third of those placements, meaning there's real high-level kids that are in these homes, and those families then needing additional support and additional skills through specialized training to care for these children.
You have a category under the primary reason children enter care, and one of them is inadequate housing. Could you elaborate on, and it's a substantial number, 7.6%. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Some of the issues around inadequate housing are going to be arrangements where children may be homeless, and there may be abusive situations, and homelessness is causing part of that, the stresses that go into families.
Well, you... then do they also show up? They're unduplicated counts, as I think you said here in this total. So would the sexual abuse or those other abuses be someplace else, and inadequate housing is just one of the other factors, or is inadequate housing the primary factor?
This is identified as a primary factor, but as you look at the numbers, they've really added up. The total number adds up to be a lot more than the 4,000 that's noted. This isn't a good measurement to show you exactly is the inadequate housing the sole and or primary reason here. That number is actually, they're all tied into one.
I see. Because, you know, the first thing that jumped out at me is that we're taking kids because the housing isn't adequate. And, right. And if there are other variables, if there's, you know, something else that's going along with it, then that wouldn't be a true characterization of this.
Correct.
So it's one of many reasons.
Correct. One of many conditions. Correct. As noted then on the bottom of page 89, the safety standards are ones that we have changed in the last 2 years, and it's requiring all families that care for children to meet the same level of safety standards. So whether they're relatives or whether they're the neighbor down the street, whether it's the teacher or whether it's a foster parent that is not known to the children, they all have the same level of standards and background checks that they must achieve. The next area is really looking at the residential treatment services. And this, too, is an array along the continuum of services that are necessary for children in the child welfare system. These children have serious behavioral and emotional problems, and they are needed to have additional treatment that cannot be done in a foster family setting of having just a mother and a father in that home. With this services, then, one of the other areas that we really focus on is the Target Planning and Consultation Committee. And this is a committee that is charged with developing specialized plans for the most difficult children we have in our system. And these are children that are unable to make it in a identified placement at this point without additional supports wrapped around them. So we have no existing residential program that can care for this child without building in other supports for that family or for that child. Oftentimes, in the olden days, these children might have been identified to move to Wisconsin or to Texas or somewhere else to get those services that may have been in another state. We have had these kids here. They get to stay in the same communities to some degree, and then we develop the wraparound services for them. Currently, we have 75 children designated for services through this additional funding. And in the last year, we served 60 children per year during the last biennium under the Target Planning Consultation Committee. And that committee is one that's unique in terms of interdisciplinary, from the representatives from mental health to our development disabilities to Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Education. So it really is everybody coming to the table trying to craft the best plan for these children to keep them at home or keep them within a safe and stable place within residential treatment. Next, I would turn to page 91 under the program performance measures. And note for a correction, the very first bullet down that we say 67%, that should actually read 60%. And that 60% of the children and youth who exit the out-of-home care system are successfully reunited with their families. The chart on the next page actually shows you where those children, when they left the out-of-home care settings, where they actually went. So 60% of these kids are able to go back home successfully. During the last several years, the Adoption Safe Families Act that has come into the child welfare system to measure performance and reporting has really established four outcome measures specific to the out-of-home care population and program areas, and those are noted here. The first one is the incident of child abuse and or neglect in foster care. And the federal definition of foster care then is the whole wide range of out-of-home care. It's not just family homes. So we as a state measure this in terms of if we have a substantiated or indicated maltreatment by a foster parent or by a residential facility is 0.57% or less. So the Oregon standard, actually, we are doing better than what we are being measured against right now. So we've achieved and are exceeding that benchmark for children in out-of-home care. And this is really being done by looking at the allegations and being able to report suspected abuse and neglect, looking at training for foster parents, what supports do they really need to have to be able to care for these children, and being able to make sure that all of our training is specific for the challenging behaviors these kids have. The second area on performance measures is foster care reentries. This is one area that measures the children who have reentered foster care within 12 months of a prior foster care episode. This means that if the child is in the foster care program and then they are reunited with their family and then come back into the foster care program again within 12 months, they're measured here. And that's the children we're identifying. So the Oregon mark right now is 12%. And that's higher than what the national median and the national standard is. And so the goal we are trying to achieve is the 8.6%. Some of the things that we are doing to try to remedy that problem to get closer to that measurement is continuing to look at our data and reporting, making sure that we're accurately reporting this information, training staff who are at the front line of working with these children and families. That data is very important to put into the system so what goes into the computer comes back out the other end correctly. we are looking at the practice issues that are continuing to be evaluated in terms of, are we assessing for change within the family? What kinds of services are we providing to that family and assess for that change so we know that mother has changed, father has changed, they've demonstrated those changes, so when these children go back home, they stay home. The stability of foster care placements is really identified as children have no more than two placement settings in the time they're in foster care in the first 12 months. So the child comes into our foster care setting to make sure that these children are not moving around the system, meaning from home to home to home. And oftentimes that's the literature, that's the information out there, that children come into foster care and they move from home to home to home to home. It's not to say that they don't do that, but we are achieving this standard at 86.3, so we're just below the national benchmark at this point in time. One of the areas that does impact this is our use of shelter homes, shelter facilities, receiving centers, those terminology that are out there on children that come into a placement that may be there for a day or two to assess their needs and then move them to a home. There's two placements right there. So in the first week to 2 weeks, if we are using shelter homes, receiving homes, centers on a real regular basis, we are going to continue to struggle with that benchmark. So the goal is to really assess that child the first time we have that child, understand the community that we have of foster parents, and be able to match those children to the correct home on day one. As you can see, we do fairly well in that measure at this point in time. Other areas that we look to make sure we're preventing the disruptions so that children aren't disrupting out of the foster homes that we've matched them to is looking at team decision-making meetings, bringing together all the players on that team, whether it's the biological families, the foster families, the caseworkers, the mental health counselor, to talk about what are the issues that are getting in the way of this child being able to stay in this home and how can we make that work. And we've used system of care funds over the last several years to help remedy some of those problems. The next area is the length of time to achieve reunification. And it is measured as for the time of discharge from foster care, 76.2% or more children reunified in less than 12 months. As you can see, Oregon at this point in time, we're at 62.9%. And that's off the federal standard of 76.2, which we're trying to achieve. This is an area that has taken a substantial change in the last biennium. And it's taken a substantial change due to Oregon's measure, how we were measuring the length of stay in foster care, and how the federal government defines length of stay in foster care. In Oregon, we define a foster care episode, meaning that when the child physically comes into our care and custody into a foster home, they're in the system. When they physically go back home to mom, they're out. But the federal standard, how they measure it, is when the child physically comes into the foster care home, they're in. And when they physically go home to mom or dad, they're on a trial home visit, and the federal government continue to call this then a foster care episode. And they keep that child identified as a foster care placement up to 6 months or until the legal custody is removed from the state. In Oregon, it is common practice here for children to go back home and the courts to continue to assign jurisdiction to the Department of Human Services for care and place and supervision of these children for 3 months or 6 months. Therefore, we measure that or are identified as needing to then claim that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. So why doesn't Oregon align their standards with the federal standards?
Yeah. Chair Gordley and Representative Smith, we have aligned that, and that's where the number has changed now. Instead of us achieving a higher standard that we were reporting last biennium, we have aligned that, and that's where we've taken that significant drop. And so some of it is coming up with trying to remediate those issues and trying to understand or explain.
Well, hopefully your numbers will look better if you align yourself with a universal measure. You know, you don't want to be looking like you're totally failing. And I mean, I'm not saying that.
Correct.
But, you know, you want, let's use all the same standard of measure so we all look the same.
Correct. And that is one of the Chair Gordley, Representative Smith, that is one of the challenges that we are struggling with in terms of where the federal government is on this definition. Many states are struggling with the same definition.
Really?
that it is new to many of us, and it's measured that there's not general consensus, but at this point in time, the federal government has defined it as they see fit. Oregon is unique in that we do keep or have care and custody of these children signed to us for extended periods of time after they've gone back home. Other states do not have that, and so that is a unique piece to us, and therefore will continue to hamper us in meeting that achievement.
Chairman Gordley and Representative Smith, I wanted just to echo that, because that's one of the things that you will see that has a potential for keeping a caseload at a place that it's not an active caseload. And we're working with the courts, because what we would like to move to is a system where if everyone is in agreement that the child has been returned home and is safe at home, that we would actually be closing that case on a timely basis and allowing staff to move forward to handle other cases. And that has been a real cultural difference that I have learned the years I've been here. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways in the community, there has been more of a tendency to say, let's keep the case open in court, and therefore Department of Human Services will be doing something with that family, when in fact that's not the reality. If safety has been assured, we'd like to move to a system in the state where we close the case. If the family needs help later, we would get re-involved with the family, but to be able to have that case reach closure, and we're working with the court system on that.
Good.
And they would bring you to the area of accomplishments during this last biennium. We currently have 4,532 certified foster care and relative families, and we've certified nearly 5,600 of those families last year. And that's known as accomplishment because that's the community that we live in that is stepping forward to care for these children. So these are all identified then on the map on the other side of the page of where those families are around the state. So they are in all communities. All our jurisdictions are providing this care for these children. And so these families are not unique to one community. These families are everywhere, and we need to continue to encourage and support families to step forward. One other piece that I would draw your attention to that Ms. Foley talked about in her first day of general overview was the fact that in this last year we had a federal review of our Title IV-E program, which looked at the certification of families, foster families, and that program review found that we were in substantial conformity, and we passed that outcome, or excuse me, that review, which was a fairly significant review last August.
If I may ask, I'm noting at the bottom of this map that there are 329 foster homes located out of state.
Correct.
And perhaps you've already addressed that point and I missed it, but can you give an example of how and why we might use a placement out of state?
Certainly, Chair Gordley. And I have not addressed it. You didn't miss anything. I didn't address this piece. Children that may be, prime example, we may have a child who is in a foster home here in the state of Oregon. For whatever reason, that family may need for work or other purposes move to another state. So they move to the state of Washington. It may be in that child's best interest to remain with that family that they've been with for some time and that they know. And then that child can go and live there. So that family technically is in another state. Oftentimes these are reflective of us trying to provide children with relatives. So maybe the auntie lives in Idaho, and so the children may go live in Idaho, and therefore they're identified as this child is still in our system, we're still responsible for them under the legal care and custody, yet that foster may actually reside in the state of Idaho.
Mm-hmm. And then I have one other question regarding the certification process. Mm-hmm. How often does the issue of prior criminal charges appear as, say, a barrier to a family or families becoming foster parents, families that might otherwise be a good placement, but the issue of a prior criminal record is in the history, and so that gets in the way of that family being looked at?
Yeah. Chair Gordley, that's a very regular occurrence in our system. It most directly affects our relative providers who we're seeking out. And it has come about through a number of years, specifically with the Adoption Safe Families Act in 1997, which put in there some federal mandates around criminal history. Mm-hmm. And it's been one that we've continued to struggle with, try to refine, try to be very sensitive to. But nevertheless, there is a line drawn in the sand to say, no, and no is the answer to certification at times.
is there a period of time that a given person who has a criminal record could go by before a person could be reassessed, or is that line in the sand that you're talking about one that is drawn forever?
Right. Chair Gordley, there are different steps along the way, and the steps being certain crimes are ones that would be never approved. That's where the line is drawn. The other ones may be the window of time, say 5 years, that it may have to do something with drugs or alcohol or something along those lines, and that folks in recovery and has been able to show. So there are a few of those areas that are identified, but there are a few that are clearly never, that are in the line, you know, in the sand. Mm-hmm. Those are reviewed then at the administrator level with Ms. Foley to review any of those kind of cases that come to her level. But the line is drawn at some of these families, absolutely.
I understand. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I first apologize for being absent. I just had a meeting with one of the co-chairs and tied me up. Not literally, but maybe. when you place children outside of their family and there's no relatives available, do you take into factors of race and ethnicity? I mean, Latinos, Latinos, blacks, blacks, Native Americans, Native Americans. Is that a part of what you try to do when you can?
Chair Gordley, Representative Bates, we, by federal law, are not going to identify the only need for this child is he's Hispanic, therefore needs a Hispanic home. But what we try to do is assess what is that child's community. And how do you define that child's community? If that child and family has defined their community as being Hispanic and having culture that really is going to prevent them from being into another family, then certainly we take that into consideration. You try to get kids into the least restrictive environment as possible, and oftentimes that is dealing with language, culture, ethnicity, geography, school, relatives. All those factors, we do our best job of assessing that at the very beginning.
Thank you.
And earlier, Representative Bates, we have a chart that actually shows the ethnicity, culture, race and culture of children, and race and culture of the families that are serving these children.
Thank you.
Please continue.
That would conclude my presentation, Chair Gordley.
Okay. We will then move on, and we are looking next at adoptions, I believe. And thank you, Kevin George, for your presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Adoption Services at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I'll refer you to the tab just immediately following Kevin's presentation. It says Adoptions, Dead Giveaway. The Department of Human Services is involved in the adoption of children primarily for one reason, and that's because we operate as the Child Protective Service Agency. As Kevin was talking, we provide foster care for these children. And when we talk about adoption, when I talk about adoption today, I am specifically talking about the movement of children from foster care into adoptions. That comprises about a third of all of the adoptions of children that occur in our state are the adoptions of children from foster care. Adoption is the preferred alternative plan for children who come into foster care and for whom the return home plan does not prove successful. We almost always start with a plan to return that child to the family from which the child came. And the most permanent alternative for most children is seen as adoption. So when we talk about adoption today, we're not going to be talking about what comes quickly to most people's minds, and that's the adoption of babies. We are talking about the adoption of older children, all of whom have special needs because they have been the victims of abuse or neglect, and that's what brought them into our care in the first place. So we'll start on page 99. And I will start kind of where Kevin left off, talking about an outcome that drives a lot of what we do. A new outcome that we're measuring since 1998 is the median number of months that children are in care between the time of their first removal from home until the adoption is finalized, even though they may be in that adoptive home for quite a long time, as you'll see in a little while, before that adoption is finalized. If there is, as Kevin was saying, children can come into care, go home, come into care, go home, and as long as there's not a break of more than 6 months, that time counts continuously. So that's what we're measuring, median length, median number of months. On page 100, you'll see that we began measuring in 1998. At that time, the median number of months was 41.7 months from first removal to adoption finalization. In 1999, for those of you who were part of this body that year, that was the year that the Adoption and Safe Families Act, the federal act, was fully incorporated into our state statute. That federal statute, and therefore our state statute, required that the children for whom we should concentrate our efforts of moving from foster care to adoption, if they were not going to be returning home, were those children who had been in care for the longest. So that would account for the decline or the worsening of our outcome for that year. She can see in 2000, we improved significantly to just under 40 months. Had a slight decline the following year to about seven tenths of a month, and then in 2001 we did exceed our benchmark by about a month, almost a month, and we are continuing at that level. By 2005 we hope to be at under 35 months. In 1999, another very significant thing happened in Oregon. We are one of seven states that now has a subsidized guardianship program. And this is specifically for children in whose best interest it is not to terminate the parental rights. The biological families remain involved with these children, but it does provide a permanency alternative for a large group of children, as you can see. It was our goal by September of 2002 to move 75 children into subsidized guardianship. And as you can see, we quadrupled that. We did 300. And that program continues to grow. On page 101, I want to talk a little bit about the factors that drive our adoption costs. First of all, identifying and evaluating the child's individual special needs and then treating those disabilities is really a large focus of our activity. One of the many reasons for doing that is because Oregon statute is very clear that we only terminate parental rights for children for whom adoption can be a viable alternative. We are not in the business, and the legislature, in its wisdom, is not in the business of creating legal orphans.
May I stop you there, Senator Shields?
You asked, your first bullet there talks about the individual's needs, treating the child's physical, emotional, and mental disabilities. Would that include fetal alcohol effect?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, absolutely. And a large portion of our children are prenatally exposed or affected by drugs or alcohol. Our estimate, and it's hard to get a good fix on that because many of those effects we don't know until later on, and if we have parents who have denied and that was not a contributing factor to them coming into care, we really don't know that those children have been prenatally exposed until later on, sometimes adolescence, when they begin some of those acting out behaviors.
Follow up?
Certainly.
So what do you do in that circumstance? I mean, 10 years down the road is kind of hard to begin catching up. and I've kind of seen this close up, and so I was wondering what you do.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I remember talking about this last session as well with you, and the best that we can do is to get a full family history, as full as the family is willing to disclose to us, to get full physicals on the child, to get them to, I'm going to use an acronym, CDRC, the Child Development and Representative Bates. Child Development and
Resource
Center, is that right?
Center, yeah.
I think. Get them full evaluations and neurological evaluations. Get the best fix on it that we can and provide the treatment. And it is our responsibility, and we have a very good track record of this, that in so far as we know conditions and circumstances of children, we disclose those. We're required by law to disclose those to adoptive parents before they, so to speak, sign on the dotted line, insofar as we know.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an area, as you are obviously aware, I'm very interested in and very concerned about. And you people are walking an incredibly fine line in determining who should have parental rights and who should not. You can't predict the future completely in that. And the key is to try to identify those kids that need to be pulled out of their family and set into an adoptive situation as quickly as possible. Because if we don't do this, we find those people, those kids grow up and then start abusing their children. The cycle never seems to end. And having now observed three generations in my community of the same families over and over and over again, and yet seeing some families somehow seem to end that through your services, and the next generation is not treated the way the previous one was, it's not a simple answer. So having said that, sort of set the question here, okay, I would like to see some information that kind of gives us a picture of these kids that are being adopted, how old they are, what some of their disabilities are, how long you've been working with those families before you had parental rights. Was it 6-7 years, and then, you know, 3 more years after you had parental rights before the child got into adoptive family, or this time they're 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. They're so badly damaged that even the best of adoptive families and all the help you give those families, it's almost an impossible task to help those kids, keep them out of the justice system, keep them out of mental health situations, and make them productive members of our society. So I'd like to kind of get a picture, not only that the adoption thing is going faster, which is difficult, but the selective process and determining when parental rights should be ended is being looked at carefully too.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that sort of the key factors in this are that many of us believe that the damage is done by the time the child is 4 years old. And if you don't intervene before the age of 4, that all the work you do afterwards can be very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing also that alcohol is the key drug as far as permanent brain damage is concerned, and that we have good records indicate that even heroin and cocaine don't do that to people, don't cause permanent brain damage, but alcohol does, which is surprising to many of us. If you could bring me something along those lines to see where we're really going, would be most important to me. And I appreciate the work you've done here. Appreciate the fact that the adoptive program is going faster, but it still seems difficult to me that we have these terribly injured children who still spend 3 years in foster care after we know we need to adopt them out. And then the difficulty is that they're so damaged that families won't adopt them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably what's slowing your process down as much as anything. Not what you're doing, but to find a family who will take one of these children on is very, very difficult. You know, it puts the child at risk, but it puts other members in that family at risk from the behaviors of that child that's being adopted in. And I think you know what I'm talking about here,
yes.
Especially sexual abuse and other efforts.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. If you bring me more data, I appreciate it.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Bates, knowing that you were on this committee and knowing your interest in this, we did prepare some materials. I think that go a part way into answering some of your questions and concerns, and we would love to have more conversation and draw on your expertise about this as we seek to continually improve our services and truly serve the needs of the children that come to our attention. So I appreciate the question and the thoughtfulness behind it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
Thank you. Second bullet. The second and the third bullets, we're on page 101. Arguably, severing the legal relationship between parents and children is the most intrusive thing that the government does in the lives of its citizens, and therefore we take it with a great deal of seriousness. So one of the things that we do is we engage the services of highly trained, specialized psychologists who assess the capacity of the parents for whom we are considering the termination of parental rights about their present capacity to care for those children, their capacity for change, using a huge battery of tests, personality tests, all kinds of psychological tests, and then testifying in court as to the outcomes on those. So I think that may answer one of your questions. That is an expensive enterprise, but it is very important because it is crucial that we make the correct decision. If the parent has a capacity to change, is on the road to change, and is clearly demonstrating that, then the state owes it to that parent to give the parent an opportunity to, again, parent that child if they have the capacity to keep the child safe on a permanent basis. Legally freeing the child for adoption, we're doing all of these things all at the same time. So we have lots of strands coming together at the same time. We have to evaluate the legal sufficiency of a case, the basis on which the child was originally removed from the home, the parent's progress toward meeting the goals of the return home plan, our ability to provide those services so that the parent can complete that in a timely manner, and evaluating the strength of the case to go toward termination of parental rights. That is, again, a costly enterprise. We engage the services of the Department of Justice, specially trained attorneys in the family law section, and in Multnomah County, we use the Multnomah County District Attorney to do that.
May I ask a question here? What should we know about the ability to provide services in the way in which you describe? In this budget environment, what's being jeopardized?
Madam Chair, I think I want to refer that question to Ramona.
Madam Chair, one of the things we do know is there's likely to be at least some chilling effect on the services that we're able to provide to families. And later when we talk about how we went about discussing priority of services, I think what we could anticipate is unless we're able to provide services to families at the time children are having to be removed, either prior to that or immediately thereafter, our goals and adoptions probably will not look quite so good in the next couple of years. Because as Kathy says, it's unlikely that any court is going to sever a parental right to a child unless a parent has been given that opportunity to access services that are appropriate to remedy the situation.
I understand. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Recruitment takes longer for certain children. This is borne out by our own records and by national research. For children of color, for older children, children with siblings needing to be placed together in adoption, and children with physical, emotional, or mental disabilities, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it's much more difficult, much more challenging to place these children than it is to place a healthy white newborn baby. So we engage in recruitment from the very beginning to look for an appropriate family where that child may end up residing for the remainder of their life. Oregon was the first state to provide adoption mediation services. We started out in 1992 offering this as an additional service for families who were considering releasing their children to place them for adoption with us when the handwriting was on the wall that most likely they would not be having their children returned to them. Mediation is now offered to a large number of families, and what it does is that it creates a legally binding agreement between the biological family and the adoptive family for continued communication between the two families when it is safe to do so after the adoption is finalized. It's incorporated into the final adoption decree, is legally binding, and both parties have an ability to remediate that later. Finally, removing financial barriers to the placement of children. Public Law 96272 in 1980 created the Federal Adoption Assistance Program. Oregon did have, by legislative action, a small adoption assistance program prior to 1980. Approximately 95% of the children under the federal and state standards qualify for adoption assistance to help to remove any financial barriers to their placement and maintenance in permanent adoptive families. On page 102, preservation and prevention services to adoptive families are provided through the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. We opened our doors in 1999, I believe, and we use purely federal 4B funds to fund this service. It's library services. We have a huge lending library, training services, family support groups, and information and referral. And finally, just want to note that our adoption assistance, that program I spoke of before, was reduced by 7.5% on February 1st. And that was done consistent with the ability under federal statute to do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry to keep slowing people down with questions.
No problem.
The families that we adopt to often, as you've noted, take on children who have huge special needs. And the support they receive from the state as part of that adoption, I think, is almost contractual. They expect to have an Oregon health plan. They expect to have special counseling. They expect to have some legal help in times if they need it. By cutting those programs, I'm fearful we're putting those adoptions at risk and those children at risk. That's my major concern. I'm also concerned whether or not we're not breaking contractual law and are going to be in a position where we might potentially see a class action lawsuit. Has that been discussed?
Chair Gordley and Representative Bates, that in fact has happened, and we have been served notice with a potential of a class action lawsuit brought by some adoptive families here in Oregon, and they are using the Youth Law Center in San Francisco as the home for looking at that bit of litigation.
Follow up, Chair.
Certainly.
I was not aware of that. I was just taking a wild stab at it. When did that happen, and when do we expect resolution? And if that resolution is the requirement that we fulfill our contract with that families, how would you go about managing that in your budget?
Chair Gordley and Representative Bates, the action was filed approximately maybe a week ago. It was during this past week or so. Had to be refiled because it named Bobby Mink, who was the former agency director, and has now been filed against Gene Thorne and the state of Oregon Department of Human Services. We anticipate that we will have a fairly vigorous conversation around this particular subject because keep in mind that it was not just adoption assistance but also foster care that took the 7.5% reduction. And the challenge, I think, will be, can the federal government require us to maintain an individual contract if the budget does not support the funding that's required in that contract? No adoptive parents were put out of the program as a result of this reduction. And that 7.5, I think if we were not to prevail in this conversation, it has implications for foster care as well, although those are not individual contracts by families. A little bit different in the technicality of how we do the foster parent payments versus the adoption assistance payments. But a number of states find themselves in the same situation and are kind of waiting to see how far this conversation goes because other states are running into the same problem. The more children that come into the adoption assistance program, it begins to exasperate the budget, and we now have more children on adoption assistance than we have in the foster care program. It's certainly not the agency's intent to reduce these payments, But as we continue talking about the budget over the next few days, I hope that you will join us in seeing that perhaps there are not other alternatives at this point. But we're certainly open to continuing that conversation, of course.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll just make a comment, and I'm afraid I'll be making these comments for the next 6 weeks. I have a real moral problem with what's happening in our state right now. When we're taking children who have been abused physically, sexually, or by drugs, and not fulfilling our contract with adoptive parents who are willing to step up and take on this huge burden, I think we have a moral vacuum we fail to fill here. And I will continue to speak out about this as we go through the session. I think we have to take the time to speak that. We haven't got a room here full of people screaming about this as we do about other things in the budget. But to simply gloss this over is something I can't do. I did not know that a lawsuit had been filed. It was my thought as I read through this last night that if I was one of these parents, I probably would be filing a lawsuit because we have failed to fulfill our responsibility to these children morally and financially. And I will be saying these things over and over again. I hope people don't get tired of it on this panel. I would apologize if you do. But I just can't let this go on and no one speak to it. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bates. Your comments are appreciated. I have another question in this area. You have referenced the legal action as one impact of these reductions. Are there any other impacts that we should be aware of as we're talking about this subject today?
Madam Chair, yes. As I stated, adoption assistance was established in 1980. It's a federal entitlement program that the state has mirrored, so it is available to all children regardless of their eligibility for the federal program. So we're 4E, we're federally funded blind. This is the first time in Oregon that we have unilaterally reduced across the board this the money that we provide. So there is a fear that does undermine the confidence of the public, of families, in the stability of the program. And that has never happened in 23 years. And therefore, it could inhibit some families from coming forward and presenting themselves as resources to adopt children. And that is of special concern for foster families with whom children have attachments, who otherwise, based on the confidence that this is a stable program, we have a quarter of a century of good track record, that it would always be there. So that is a concern around our ability to place children for adoption in the future.
Thank you. And
it's said in such a nice, sanitized way. That's my only comment.
What we appreciate is you're being forthright in the manner that you are. That's also required. So thank you, and please continue.
Madam Chair, I feel bad because I said what I said. I don't mean to say negative things to the department because they're doing a good job. I just see it through the eyes of the pain, the ripple effect. And this is just one program we're dismantling. We're dismantling the whole damn state, excuse me for a second. I mean, while we're doing this, we're doing everything else. You can't see it in isolation, and it becomes frustrating after a while.
Your words are understood. Please continue.
Okay, we're still on page 102. For those of you who were here in 1997, there was a legislative task force on adoption services that was put together, and it had four goals. The goals were to increase the number of children moving from foster care to adoption, to reduce the median length of time to achieve adoption, to streamline our systems and processes, and to provide post-adoption support. We have done really well against all four of those outcomes. We have increased by 162% since 1995 the number of children annually moving from foster care to adoption. And many of those, as our median length of time indicates, are children who had been in the system for a very, very long time. And the addition of the assisted guardianship program has helped us to move even more children than we had initially anticipated on into permanency. In 2002, as Ms. Foley said, children in the subsidized adoption assistance program and subsidized guardianship program now represent a larger portion of all children served by our agency than they did in 1997. And the average daily population of children in adoption and guardianship has now outstripped the average daily population of children in foster care. A little later, I'll give you some actual numbers on those. The per unit cost comparisons, this refers to, from where I sit, the amount of monthly adoption subsidy that we provide to adoptive parents. It's just under $400, and that puts us right about the middle of the 50 states in the median amount of adoption assistance that we supply, with the 7.5% that includes the 7.5% reduction. We'll move to page 104. This is how we factor out length of time to achieve a finalized adoption. We've seen some good movement in this of more children ending up in those sooner categories than the later categories. And overall, we've made some very good progress in reducing the time. The length of time to achieve adoption, again, is from the first, because it's from the first day of care to finalization, is driven by several factors. First of all, the difficulty in resolving the safety and legal issues for the child, so providing the services to the family so that the child can safely return there. The complexity and severity of the child's special needs. We certainly don't want to move to terminate a child's parental rights before we know that there might be a plan of adoption for that child. And finally, recruiting, training, and assessing families does take time. On page 105 shows our steady progression in the number of children moving from foster care to adoption each year. We anticipate that in 2003 this number will begin to drop for a number of reasons. One is budgetary. And we have had a slowdown since December in establishing adoption assistance while we figure all what all of this means legally. So we've had some slowdown there as well. In addition, gosh, it sounds like a disrespectful term, and it's not meant to be that. When Adoption and Safe Families Act, what became law in Oregon, we identified what were the quote-unquote bulge kids, and that was a big group of kids who had been in care in excess of the federal timelines for the filing of termination of parental rights, so we knew that we had a lot of children in a 4 to 5 year period of time who would be moving on. We now have passed that peak, and we expect that number to begin to drop. Nearly, on page 106, nearly all of the children, as I said before, that we place for adoption fall into one of these categories. They're six or older, they're part of a sibling group, they're part of an ethnic minority, or they have a handicapping condition. 51% of the children whose adoptions finalized in 2001, and just less than that the last year, were over the age of six at the time of adoption. Again, not babies. On page 107, this is a new chart that we're providing you for the first time, and it came out of questions from a couple of legislators who were concerned about what we were doing about siblings. We recognize that a child's relationship with their siblings, a person's relationship with their siblings, is probably the single most important relationship, lifelong relationship, that they will ever have. Children generally outlive their parents, and so it's even more important for for the sibling relationship to continue. In addition to that, when children have been traumatized, it sometimes is the only link that the child has to some sort of healthy past, and to help create and maintain some memories of that. So we have produced this chart on page 107 that shows that well over 90% of the children who had a sibling available for adoption at the same time were placed with that sibling or siblings in adoption. If you look at the number of families who adopted sibling groups of 4, 5, or 6, I just think that it's just, those are the absolute heroes in our state that they took that kind of responsibility on. Even the families that adopted 3 children is a phenomenal number. Let's move to page 109. Representative Bates, to one of the questions that you had, I think. I want to apologize first for the terminology that's used. This is the old shorthand off our computer system. I understand and I realize that this is really neither politically correct nor a respectful way to refer to the children in our care. The graph these numbers will never add up to 100%, so don't look for that. Each pair is 2 years. The lighter colored dark bar is 2001, the darker is 2002. And this is, children can have more than one of these conditions. So as you can see, the emotionally disturbed, it's the highest bars, the biggest bars. Over 85% of our kids, 85% of kids, 80% are diagnosed by a professional as being emotionally disturbed. Medically diagnosed conditions is the next largest category. I am anticipating that someone wants to ask the question about why is the percentage in each category smaller in 2002 and in 2001, and as well as we can tell, it is a long-term effect of the Adoption and Safe Families Act. It follows the age of the child. We are placing children more quickly into the homes that will become the permanent adoptive homes, and we're doing that with younger and younger children, so that it does mitigate somewhat the damage. So that would bear out, I think, what you had to say, Representative Bates. Moving on to page 110, let's talk a little bit about adoptive family characteristics. Again, these are questions that a couple of your colleagues are keenly interested in. We have seen in the last 10 years a huge shift in practice around who adopts children. We used to discourage relatives from adopting because the belief was that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And we used to discourage foster parents from getting attached to children, thinking that foster parents were one kind of people and adoptive parents were another kind of people. So we even, in the way olden days, moved foster children every 6 months so they wouldn't get attached to their caregivers. Now that practice has flip-flopped, and we want to have the child in what potentially could become their permanent placement as quickly after they come into care as possible, and to minimize the damage that can be caused by repeated moves. So 37% were adopted by their relatives for the last 2 years, and 35% by their non-related foster parents. So over 70% of the children got to a place where they were being cared for by a stable family and did not move again when it came time to do an adoption. That's good. 28% were then adopted by non-related families that we went out and recruited for adoption in Oregon and across the country. 82% were adopted right here in Oregon. 18% went out of state. 79% were adopted by families that came directly to us and worked directly with us, and the remainder went to a different agency but still had access to our children. 77% were adopted by married couples. We have lots of single parents adopting children. and 68% were adopted by families in which at least one of the adoptive parents was of the same race or ethnicity as the child. Our selection of the most appropriate adoptive family, much to the chagrin of people applying for adoption, is always driven by the needs of the child. The child is our client. The adoptive parents are our customers, and we owe it to them to take good care of them, to treat them respectfully, to give them timely services, and to do placements with them as timely as we're able to do so. But really, we are driven by what family can best meet the needs of this particular child. Earlier, you asked, Kevin, about placement of children with families of the same race or ethnicity. The Multi-Ethnic Placement Act prohibits, when it comes to adoption, prohibits the denial or delay of adoptive placement of a child on the basis of the race or ethnicity of the adoptive parent or of the child. It is, however, one of the things that we take into consideration. The chart on page 111, first of all, the narrative at the bottom has a typo in the fourth line down. It isn't 5%, it's 15%. This is a chart about which we are especially proud in Oregon. It is our disruption rate. Disruption is described as from the time we identify the family and legally designate them as the adoptive family, even though the child could have been there for months or even years on a foster care basis, once we make the legal designation of that family as the adoptive family, until the time that we are finished with the case and the adoption is finalized. If the child comes out of that home and doesn't return, that's an adoption disruption. We have always been below the national standard on this. We, this last year, achieved a very good low of only 6.5% of our children disrupted. We owe that to the great care that we take in selecting adoptive families and in trying to make sure before we call it an adoption that the family truly can meet that child's needs and they know what they're getting into. On page 112, over the past 10 years, we have doubled the number of children each year that we free for adoption. About a quarter of them now are released voluntarily by their parents, and that usually is done after we present to them the evidence that we are going to be putting on in court, and they decide that they want to help to plan the adoption of their child rather than go through the painful termination of parental rights. Just under 40%, we have to go to court, and they're freed through involuntary means, and about the remaining third are freed through some combination. So one parent may release, the other parent we have to go to court on. We use technical assistance out of our central administrative offices. We have special staff that has been around for years who carefully evaluate with our attorneys the legal sufficiency of cases and the adoptability of the children. We get legal services, as I had mentioned before. We employ private investigators to serve families with notice of court hearings on a timely basis. And we have more than 30 specially trained adoption mediators. And in a two-year period of time, we did over 600 referrals to mediation. This is specifically adoption mediation. On page 113, in a two-year period of time, since we were here last session, we've completed over 1,200 adoption studies. And then the Special Needs Adoption Coalition here in Oregon completed a little over 100 additional. We provide adoptive families do a lot of recruitment in-state and out-of-state. We screen and assess them so that if they are not appropriate as adoptive candidates for these children, they know as early as possible provide pre-service training that is required, and it's a training specific to the needs of the kinds of children that we have in our care. Do a comprehensive home study, which may be the second most intrusive thing we do into families' lives, is to subject them to these home studies. And then we refer the families to those workers who have children available for a potential match. And we continue to provide them with support services. We have a lot of private participation through contractual arrangements with many agencies, both inside and out of the state, to help in all of these efforts to recruit and to train and to assess families. We're currently using the services of the Northwest Adoption Exchange. I have done that for over 20 years, who post children to a website as is required by federal law. And we are in the process of participating in the new national website called Adopt U.S. Kids. On page 115, this just clearly and graphically shows the increase in the number of children receiving adoption assistance benefits. It is 115% increase. It is not 162% increase, which is the increase in the number of children moving to adoption, because when children turn 18, they age off adoption assistance. That's where it ends. So the program has now been around long enough that we have children at 18. They're off. On page 116, post-adoption services. DHS has a commitment to adoptive families to provide services to them throughout the childhood of the child that they've adopted. So we have an open door policy. They can come back and knock on the door of any DHS office and request services. We help them to place those children in treatment centers if that's necessary. We provide post-adoption family treatment, adoption assistance, and then the services of the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center. And currently, as of the end of December, 8,300 children had identified special needs and were receiving one or more of these services. The adoption assistance consists of these parts: a medical card, which is used as a secondary insurance, a reimbursement of the non-recurring expenses of up to $2,000 that are incurred in the course of establishing the adoption, special one-time payments for things like maybe building a wheelchair ramp or something that is connected to the child's special needs that is not covered by some other state or federal program, and then finally the monthly subsidy check, which at this point in time the median is $396. Special needs adopted children also place very high needs, as you know, on all the other services in our communities, on schools, on medical and mental health facilities. And finally, I think we're getting to the end. Guardianship assistance services were one of seven states participating in a waiver, and by our agreement with you, I think in 1999, I believe it was, those families for whom we establish guardianship assistance after the waiver ends will continue to be supported with state-only funds, but we won't establish any new guardianships unless we come back next session and talk to you about that. The children that are most of the children that we're serving are children in the guardianship program are children who are being who are living with relatives, and it's not in the child's best interest. They have a pre-existing relationship with their biological parents who may just not be available to parent them. We think the relative is a safe resource, but the grandma wants to continue to be grandma, doesn't want to be parent to the child. And so many of those children, most of the children, are typically these children. Guardianship assistance benefits pretty much mirror adoption assistance benefits, and we've set up the programs to be fairly parallel. Finally, on page 119, We provide regulatory oversight to all of the adoptions that occur in the state of Oregon. In the last year, 2,500 children were adopted and 1,900 petitions, more than one child to a petition. That would include things like step-parent adoptions, independent infant adoptions that are arranged through attorneys, adoption agencies, and relative adoptions if families just arrange that privately, and then foreign readoptions or international readoptions. We also administer the Interstate Compact on the placement of children, not only for the children in our care, but for all children moving over state lines, not with their parents. And on page 120 is just a summary of our adoptive placement services. We are working very, very hard to minimize the number of moves, to keep children as close to their communities, and to minimize the trauma to them as possible. So we have several initiatives going on across the state to identify potential adoptive homes in children's own communities and from their circle of family, friends, teachers. We provide an ongoing evaluation of the children's special needs and knowing always that our ability to free them and place them for adoption is really based on our ability to have good information and disclose that information to the people that need it.
I have a question for you. There is some information that you passed over in a very thorough presentation, by the way, on page 117, and it's referencing the guardianship demonstration project and the relationship of this project to or the work that is being done in conjunction with tribal courts. And I was particularly noticing that last statement, that in some cultures, particularly in some Native American tribal communities, termination of parental rights goes against long-held cultural and family traditions. And so what happens when you come into contact or into conflict with those long-held traditional beliefs? What do you do?
Madam Chair, the federal government has now recognized the tribe's ability to participate in the permanency planning for these children. The state, I think, traditionally has taken a view that adoption is the most permanent option for children. But now we have a very close relationship with the tribes here in Oregon. We work with the tribes, and we try to respect the tribes' beliefs, that if it's not in the tribe's best interest as well as the child's best interest, that those rights be severed. If the tribe can provide us with some resource, a family resource, and that they want to participate in the planning for the child, guardianship is a wonderful, wonderful option. When one of the considerations with tribal children is that if we or they don't have available a tribal home, and the child has his or her parental rights severed, the tribal rights don't terminate there. The child is forever whatever tribe they were. That's a national origin. But the ability to pay attention to the child's cultural needs, if they're not in that tribe, are somewhat inhibited. And so we're working very hard with the tribes to not do that.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up, how would you evaluate your, for lack of a better word, success in this arena? Looking at the best interest of the child, how are you doing?
Madam Chair, I think that one of the outcomes we would want to look at would be the number of children for whom the return home plan is not successful, who have the active participation of their tribes in the decision-making for the child, and that that's clearly documented. And the second outcome I think I would look at would be the number of Native children who have the means to maintain tribal connections.
Madam Chair, also to the question you raised earlier, one of the considerations is with families that are tribal, we are supposed to meet a qualification called active efforts, which is a higher standard really than reasonable efforts, and we've been talking about reasonable efforts with many of our families. But the federal government also requires active efforts, which means we have a higher standard to get services to these families if children come into care, and a higher standard to try to get children back home to their tribal families, as opposed to seeking another alternative of permanency until we've exhausted reunification.
That's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It would also be useful if you're able to prepare a document that outlines what your work has been in this area. That would be very helpful to the committee.
Madam Chair, there is an active efforts work group that is preparing that kind of document.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much. And thank you for a fine presentation.
Thank you.
Questions or?
Yeah, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Bates.
Two last questions. Okay. I'm going to go back to page 110 because I want you to have a chance to complete your presentation before I ask any more questions.
Okay.
I want to make sure you have a chance to finish before it was up. On 110, you talked about 37% of these children were adopted by their relatives and 35% by their non-related foster parents. The question I had concerning this, and I hope the answer is yes, is that these are kids who were placed with their relatives or placed with foster parents who ultimately adopted them. So from the child's point of view, it was a matter of a piece of paper getting signed. Those children were in that home for a long period of time in foster care, but ultimately were adopted by those families, that means about 70-75% of your kids are placed at some kind of a foster setting with relatives or non-relatives and ultimately get adopted. Is that an assumption on my part that's correct, or is that not what's happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, you're almost 100% right.
That's the best I ever do.
Pretty good. The 37% who are adopted by their relatives, how that breaks out is 34% were by relative caregivers. And so you're right about them. They went to the relatives and they didn't move. The remaining 3% were relatives that very early on in case planning before we get to the six-month mark, which is what we have in administrative rule, we have identified some relative that there is a barrier to the placement with that relative. It could be Aunt Susie in Florida, and getting a home study in a timely way out of another state is challenging. And so the child eventually moves there, and we have identified that as a resource early on, but it does involve a move. But that's only 3% of the children. The other 34 were with those relatives. With their non-related foster parents, you're absolutely right. Many times that's their one and only placement. They came into care and they stayed right there. More and more in our training, we combine the training of foster and adoptive parents, and resource families really come in thinking. And we talk with them, and it's a difficult line to follow because on the one hand, they're working with the child and the family toward the return home plan. On the other hand, they are attaching and becoming a surrogate parent to that child and thinking about becoming the permanent resource to that child should that plan fail. It's a very difficult job.
Thank you. Last question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Where is this agency going with budget cuts? What is going to happen to these children in your mind?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I am just delighted that I get to let Ramon answer this last question.
Madam Chair, thank you, Kathy. Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I think clearly this demonstrates that the commitment that people make to children in our system is way beyond the matter of assistance. I think that I wouldn't be naive enough to say that this won't have this has a chilling effect on families, but I think it's, as Kathy identified earlier, is as much about a lack of trust in that they don't feel like, families don't feel like we may be living up to the agreements we made with both foster families and adoptive families in this state. But by and large, one of the conversations I've had with a couple of foster families has been around the fact that we are also reducing TANF payments. Oh, there I am. Temporary assistance to needy families. We are reducing those payments to intact families. Mm-hmm. And as foster families look at that, they say, wait a minute, this pain is spread across the entire system. They're not seeing it as only directed at foster families, and I think the adoption families are not seeing it only directed at adoptive families, especially when they understand the cuts to families that are still intact, trying to get employment and trying to keep their children safely at home. So I think it's a matter of the commitment these folks make to children is just beyond belief, and I think most of those families will continue to hang in there, hoping, like the rest of us in Oregon, that things will get better and that this is a period of time we're going through that will not, you know, carry us for the next several years.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you again. Where would you like to go next, Ms. Foley? Program support, central administration? Would you
we're
like
prepared
to start
to do,
that?
Yes, we're prepared to do that. Tom Finske is going to join me, I think. Oh, okay. To prepare for that, one of the things we thought it might be helpful to do is to, in our books on page 2-7, when we first opened the Children, Adults, and Families presentation, we did reference this organization chart. And so what you have been hearing over the 4 days of testimony for Children, Adults, and Families references the work that occurs within this chart. And, of course, after public testimony, we'll be going to the chart for Community Human Services, which is the field structure where work actually happens at a frontline level. But if you look at page 2.2-7, I can share with you very quickly that the kinds of activities that, for example, happen in the assistant director's office, that's the administrative group up at the top, the 16.50, that is, has in the past included system of care. Of course, we've reduced those positions. Now those positions are eliminated, the system of care positions. But it includes our tribal liaison work with the tribes around Oregon. It includes policy writing. It includes a reception desk in our building, and the administrative support, which is the clerical support for administration. If you look at the little four boxes right below that, the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits, that includes prevention, which is our AmeriCorps program, works a lot with teen pregnancy, food stamps, it includes the overpayments function, policy and rules coordination for the cluster, and some Medicaid policy is also in that particular group. And you see the number of FTEs there across the bottom of these little boxes. The Office of Self-Sufficiency and Child Safety, if you recall, Michael Buckley was testifying from that group, and that includes the temporary assistance to needy families, employment and training, the refugee program, employment-related child care, family-based services, child protective services, and the family-to-family, which is an Annie Casey grant that we have in the department. The Office of Permanency for Children, headed up by Nancy Keeling, that includes the two presentations you've heard today, all of the central office work that goes into that, and there are functions in central office that we do directly, like the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children. We have a unit that handles that for the entire state. Kathy Ledesma's presentation, much of our adoptions work is centralized, and we do that work out of the central office. Foster care and residential care. We do the licensing of children's homes, not foster families, but of the children's homes and residential treatment facilities. The contractual work is done out of our part of the department. And it also includes, in Nancy Keeling's area, the training. The training for our economic services programs, and then the training contract with Portland State University for the training of child welfare staff. And then that last little block is the Office of Program Performance and Reporting, headed up by Margie Lau, and that is our federal compliance staff, our program quality assurance. We are now doing, for example, a We mimic the federal review that we had done in the state of Oregon in child welfare. We're doing that same type of review in each of our counties every biennium at this point. And so that work is done out of that particular cluster. Program system support, monitoring children's benefits, and data reporting is all done about out of the Office of Program Performance and Reporting. So I wanted to kind of give you that high-level view of what those pieces are about as Tom talks more specifically about the budget.
Now, if I could ask a question here, because what you've presented is the 2001-2003 organization chart. Anything about this chart changing in 2003-2005, including the number of positions in each of the different categories?
Chair Gordley, this is as of right now, but it has changed over the biennium. With the reorganization primarily, and we'll talk a little bit about that, we've seen a tremendous shift from about half of the staff that was in the old Adult and Family Services and in the old State Office with Services to Children and Families, half of that staff are in other places or have been eliminated. And so this is as of right now. And we don't know, of course, what it will look like as we go into the 2003-2005.
Okay. This is today's snapshot.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Fenske with Department of Human Services Finance and Policy Analysis. Several weeks ago when we started these proceedings, Sheila Baker gave a high-level overview of the budget. I think she started at 40,000 feet or something like that. And Pam Tessner took us to a lower level. I'm going to try to take us even lower today and hopefully avoid crash landing. I'll be referencing the document starting on page
4-123.
Before we get into that material, there's a handout. Have you received this? Okay. Just this is an outline of the governor's balanced budget for children, adults, and families. You have, over the last couple of weeks, heard the program staff talk about the functions and outcomes of self-sufficiency, child safety, and the major areas in children, adults, and families budget. These are the numbers. This is the budget that supports those functions and outcomes. This is where we're going with the discussion today. I just wanted to show you where we're going to end up. We're going to go back now about a year to the development of the budget to get to those numbers. On page 4-123, you see the base budget for children, adults, and families. Mm-hmm. This is essentially the 0103 legislatively approved budget as of the April emergency board with some adjustments for 2003-2005 clause. So that's the starting point. Below that, you see a summary of...
If I may interrupt you, Representative Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me sort of get a little closer definition here so I can understand what we're talking about. The general funds for the governor's balanced budget, this is the 2003-2005 budget, I assume, not the end of the 2001-2003. It has to be 2003-2005. It's based on the cuts that were made.
Is this what you're referring to, this handout?
I'm at 4-123.
Okay.
That's a 103. I'm trying to match these two up. You got 222 and you got 211.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I might, I believe what we're trying to do here is walk through how the budget was built from the base budget, which was the 0103 budget as of April 2002. Then there are a number of adjustments that are going to be discussed, and that gets to this sheet with the 0305 governor's budget, recognizing, as indicated, that this is the governor's balanced budget that came out at the start of the session and doesn't reflect some of the adjustments that have been made since then. or that we would anticipate making. And I think we mentioned yesterday that there would be a reshoot of the governor's 03-05 budget, a recasting, if you will, rebalancing of that budget. But this is to walk through the elements of change from the 01-03 budget as of April 02 to the governor's balanced budget as it was promulgated in January. Does that help?
To a degree, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
So the sheet you've had is this one?
Yes.
That is the original 03-05 governor's budget based on the revenue forecast that he was given in January of this year?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is correct. I thought it would be useful to see the end point where we're going to be going as we walk through the actions taken since the beginning of the development of this budget. And I apologize if that was misleading or confusing. But since we've been talking about the children, adults, and families budget by the different categories, I thought it would be useful to see the budget broken down by those same categories so you can see the central administration program support and the other various budgets. But you're correct. This is the governor's balanced budget based on I can't remember when it came out, but it was
I believe it was in mid-January of
yeah, so
year.
It doesn't take into account the most recent forecast, revenue forecast, but it does include the December revenue forecast.
Madam Chair, I don't want to get ahead of your discussion. If you wanted to bring us up to date from what's happened between January and now, what the budget would look like now and the rebalance, in many of the committees that are meeting, we've just automatically cut that figure down dramatically. Co-chairs wanted us to, and we've even gone deep in that in some other areas, trying to get what we hope is a realistic budget to look at. Is that where you're planning to go with this discussion?
Where I thought I'd go with this discussion is the development of this, because quite frankly, I don't know where we're going to end up. I mean, the governor's balanced budget is the last. The last numbers that we have to tie to as we go through the development.
Madam Chair, I just say as a caveat that as we look at these figures, that we may be reducing them backwards, downwards, as revenue forecasts continue to fall, and we should keep that in the back of our minds.
I understand where you're going, Representative Bates. And Ms. Baker, did you want to weigh in here?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I was just going to basically reiterate what Representative Bates just said is that we will, as we move forward to the reshoot of the governor's budget, and then as we get into work session, we will be looking at this point anyway, looking at reductions to the governor's balanced budget overall. But in terms of the committee understanding what's in the governor's balanced budget as a starting point, that's what we wanted to put on the table today.
That's very helpful. And if you would like to continue in the 6 minutes we have remaining.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, that's quite all right. A part of what we're trying to achieve here is clarity. That comes with questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the essential packages 010 to 060 add a little over $50 million in total funds to the children, adults, and families budget. Most of those funds come in the 030 and 040 packages, which are inflation and mandatory caseload increases. From there, we move into more recent packages, the 080, 081, and those you probably know them better as the actions that were taken in the June 02 e-board, third special session, November 02 e-board, House Bill 5100. And then additional changes in the 092 packages, which include the elimination of the inflation that I just mentioned was added in the 030 package, as well as a partial restoration of the system of care budget for 0305. From there, the only other change to get us to the governor's balanced budget was the transfer of child support to the Department of Justice.
Senator Carter,
is that in keeping with the issue of trying to get better efficiency on the legal side? Tell me why was this done. I mean, I've seen it go four different ways, four different times. I can't make up my mind, but tell me why is this one done?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I understand it, there is a budget note to this effect on page 4128.
Oh, okay.
The transfer of child support to the Department of Justice was directed by the Department of Administrative Services to, I think, to increase the efficacy of the program.
I've been here long enough to have seen it done the other way, too, and I was wondering why we'll be coming back to a point where we used to be a long time ago. What was the efficacy of this? And thank you.
Madam Chair, if you'd like more information on that, I'd be happy to get that for you.
Thank you.
So once you add in the packages that we just discussed and the policy package 162 for the transfer of child support, that brings us down to, if you look at the bottom of page 4, 127, the governor's balanced budget for children, adults, and families, which includes total funds of approximately $1.5 billion.
I see. I get it finally.
Okay.
We're all tracking. Okay.
You want to quit while you're ahead, or?
Well, I just didn't know we were going to do all this, and finally, okay, match. It makes sense.
Great.
Jeez.
Did you use the federal match?
Please continue.
Madam Chair, I've essentially taken us through very quickly the process of developing the children, adults, and family budget from the base established in April last year to what we know as the governor's balanced budget today. And the handout, again, that I gave you is ties to these same numbers that are on the bottom of page 4127, but broken down by the different structures of our budget that you heard the program staff discuss in the last couple weeks.
And the budget notes referenced on our agenda, those are the budget notes on page 4128.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And I believe that they have been discussed in over the course of the presentation.
Are there any other questions or comments for Mr. Finsky before we adjourn for the afternoon? Okay. Senator Morris.
May I back up the question on adoptions? Maybe we might answer that. My question would be, how many children are in the system total? Do you have information with respect to the numbers, you know, that cycle through on a yearly basis? How many are receiving payments? Families receiving stipends.
Chair Gordley and Senator Morris, is your question related to how many children in adoption assistance, how many are in adoption, or how many are in adoption assistance, which means...
Well, we have the figure roughly, I think, the figure 2,189 that seem to be kind of on an annual basis coming into the system. How many children are receiving assistance in addition to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, if I'm interpreting your question correct, and please correct me if I'm not, of the children coming into foster care...
For the record, if you would re-identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. of the children who come in to foster care remain in care for more than 60 days. Mm-hmm. Currently, 23% of those then receive those services toward freeing them and placing them for adoption. Currently, it's about 23%. In raw numbers, how that factors out is currently we have about 1,700 children in the adoption track who are in one stage or another of being freed for adoption, having a family identified for them, and moving on. And then a total of a little over 8,000 children that still get some assistance from the state and are already in their finalized adoptive placements. Does that answer your question?
If the 8,000 covers children that have been adopted and are still families who are receiving assistance.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Foley, how much time will you need to complete the final item on the agenda? Is that something that can carry over?
It certainly may carry over, Madam Chair.
Tomorrow? Okay.
Madam Chair, tomorrow we've scheduled public testimony, and then the idea would be to wrap up this children, adults, and families discussion on Thursday, and assuming that we have time, go into the community human services pieces, which are the field staffing and the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. So get into that on Thursday, and this would then carry over until Thursday.
All right. We'll just make a note of that for the chair. And thank you all for your presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.